This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 102nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Come and have a go if you think you're replete with the requisite cross-section of cultural stories to inform, educate and entertain. That's our aim, friends, the pricking up of ears. This week we're inspecting some paintings, soaking up a bit of art around Europe, from Berlin via Stockholm to Madrid.
Fairs tend to be quite generic. In this case, I think the curated projects have really tried to do something very different.
And what does a rock fan do in a country with no rock stars? Well, in Qatar, one guy's picked up a guitar and released an album. We'll be chatting to him.
I'm here now, and if they don't want to print about me or write about me, I'll make them write about me.
And talking of guitars, we've got front row seats at the launch event of a new book focusing on their little cousin. Who's that, I hear you ask? The ukulele, of course.
Why do you play it rather than any other instrument?
You can practice in bed.
Plus, we're getting a bit jazzy with Julia Holter in this week's Midori House session, and we'll find out how a kitchen window inspired Allen Ginsberg at London Design Week. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So first up, we're kicking back for this week's session, which comes courtesy of LA's Julia Holter, who straddles the boundaries of experimental jazz and pop, and elegantly so. She just released her third album, Loud City Song, which she described as a coming-of-age story, and she stopped by to play us a few tracks. Here she is with This Is a True Heart.
This just overflowed all our thoughts.
This is A True Heart by Julia Holter there, and of course we'll be getting a little bit more from her and getting to know her a little better later on in the show. As ever, the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness is bringing its share of art happenings. We'll be hearing from the Istanbul Biennale next week, and Freeze London is also lurking on the horizon. But this week, we decided to stop in at a few spots in Stockholm, Madrid, and first, Berlin. ABC Art Berlin Contemporary, an art fair in all but name, began in 2008 as a rogue curated off event in which Berlin galleries could experiment with exhibiting just one artist each. Now it's the main place to buy art during Berlin's new citywide Berlin Art Week, which also includes big exhibitions in museum and project spaces. This year, ABC, which has just wrapped up, featured 133 galleries from Berlin and beyond, and for the first year had an artistic director, Maike Kruse. Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley spoke to her about ABC's newest phase and how Berlin might strengthen its position in the art market.
I'm more maybe a moderator for the galleries than a curator, because it's not an exhibition anymore. It used to be a curated show. What we do now is that we invite galleries that we whose program we like, and they can then propose a position of their own. So it's all single positions that we show, and we don't call us a fair for two reasons. One is because we try to develop a totally different format to a fair. We don't have booths, we don't have the program of the gallery, we only have single positions, and it's far more open and experimental from its structure. So basically, you don't have so many rules, you know. You can expand as much as you want. You can hang something from the ceiling. You can do a dance performance. It's all possible. The other reason why we don't call us a fair is that we are not owned by a fair company, and also not by an investor. So we are a private initiative, which means that we are financially and structurally totally different to a bigger fair.
How many galleries are here, and where do they come from?
There's 133 galleries from all over the world, so half the galleries come from Berlin, the other half comes from the rest of Germany, from Europe, from the Middle East, from North and South of America, and from Africa, so really from all over the world.
It's a huge mix here. Could you describe some of the more spectacular pieces that people might be able to see?
I mean, there's a lot of spectacular works. The ones that I like the most are really the ones where the galleries used the special format of ABC and really used the openness and the experimental way you can present the art here. What I really like, for example, is that Maya Riga is showing a dance performance by Alexandra Bartzitzis. Then Hauser & Wirth is presenting the Christoph Schlingensief Operndorf, which is put together by three artists who worked about the Operndorf, and it's Anri Sala, Andy Hope, and Aino Labarenz. And they did a huge structure, and then there's also sound from Burkina Faso. They will do interviews to Burkina Faso, so it will be very lively.
Berlin is not famous for having a strong collector base. Do you have any prognosis for sales this time, or any thoughts on how Berlin could be more of a sales center?
I mean, that's a difficult question, because it's difficult to say that before the show, you know. You can ask me again in 1 week. But we worked a lot on this, because of course that's something that we try to do. We really want to support the gallery system. We want to activate the art market also here in Berlin. That's what ABC is for. And we really worked a lot on the database for collectors, on inviting really the younger, newer collectors, on inviting a lot of people from Berlin who moved here recently, where we think there's a lot of movement actually. And I mean, the whole format of ABC, it's very easy for international great galleries like Mendes Wood or Hauser & Wirth to participate here, because it's you focus on one work and the participation fee is very low. So we try, on the one hand, we try to get really great galleries also from outside here, and then also of course we try to drag collectors in the art world here. And I'm very optimistic that this year I know of a lot of really great people who are coming. So of course at the moment I can't say if they buy, but I very much hope so.
That was Maike Kruse, director of ABC Art Berlin Contemporary, speaking to Kimberly Bradley. Next up on our European tour, we're off to Spain. The new art season is kicking off in Madrid, and private galleries across the city geared up at the weekend for the fourth edition of Apertura. The new edition this year was SUMA, a contemporary art fair hoping to rouse a new generation of collectors and galleries alike. A noble mission indeed, but a challenge to say the least in Spain. So we sent our correspondent Liam Aldous to find out what sets this fair apart from all the rest.
The collectionism in Spain is an old-fashioned collectionist, and we try to get up different age and different people and to try to begin new collections. We focus in all kind of artists. We have a section of video, and yesterday we had a performance by Susan Dehim, and the idea is to join all kind of arts and together everybody see what's happening in the art world.
That was Quique Polanco, the director of the new SUMA Art Fair in Madrid, which over 4 days is breathing fresh life into the art fair concept. To ensure this new voice is heard, over 3,000 international collectors have been invited. There is a series of high-profile roundtable discussions and even a royal visit to provide the requisite media buzz.
I think one of the reasons that everyone has such fascination for contemporary visual arts...
It's smaller scale, so you can really see everything. It's more spacious. Fairs tend to be quite generic. In this case, I think the curated projects have really tried to do something very different.
Alexia Tala is a Chilean curator who has brought together a selection of Spanish and international galleries in the Transversal Emergente section.
It's a section dedicated to more mid-career, not as established artists as the other section. And I've titled the selection of projects. I've titled it I Could Have Not Noticed It, because it really looks into projects developed by artists in different geographies, where they actually look into a different context. It's not just a selection of works, but there are works that actually have a narrative and that they communicate and they have a dialogue with each other.
In the dark but nonetheless welcoming neighbouring pavilion, I meet Neria Obieto, who has curated the video art section titled An Easy Pleasure.
Normally, people think about pleasure as the opposite of discomfort, but it's not really like this, because there are some gray spaces. I think video art now is as important as photography or painting. It's really difficult to show video art because normally it needs time to stop and watch the video, and it is difficult in a fair, because you are in a hurry and you want to see everything, and it's difficult to stop and watch the video. But if you've got a section that you can see all the videos and go walking all in the same room, it's a space which invites you to stay and contemplate.
It's not all about focusing on emerging talent, though. Agustin Perez Rubio has curated a section that brings together the earlier works of established female artists.
Some of the artists, like for example Liliana Porter, when I talk with her about, oh, I would love to show your pieces from 70s that is more related with geometry and feminism, she said, oh, this is not very famous, maybe the people would love to show more the pieces from these Mickey Mouse or these pop things in between the photographies. But I said, no, but I want to show more the story. No, I think that it's important that in a very young art fair, not only to show the pieces or artwork from and generations. I think that the most important is to give like a historical background and a concept and what does it mean history and our past. All of the women that participate in these project rooms are 12 women artists from Europe and Latin America, that they are developing a lot of practices on performance and conceptual art.
With Madrid's art scene battling against a crippling tax increase, bold new initiatives like the SUMA Art Fair reveal that the industry, and particularly its younger players, are responding not just with solidarity, but with a clearer focus. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
And from Spain, our final stop on this little European art tour is Sweden. Last week, Stockholm was swinging to the announcement and attendant bashes of the Absolute Art Award. The prizes for artists and art writers were won by Renata Lucas and Coco Fusco, respectively. But what happened when you left the clamour of the awards ceremony behind and wandered about town? Well, you came upon some august contemporary galleries, like Nordenhecker, a gallery that's been showing a mixture of Swedish and international artists since Claes Nordenhecker first set up shop in Malmö in 1973. For a few remaining days, Meriç Algun Ringborg, a Turkish-Swedish artist, was showing a work of fiction, an amazingly multifaceted show that addressed the very nature of creation. Artistic, that is. Gallery chief Ben Lovelace walked me through this make-believe, this work of fiction.
Berlin has been and continues to be a really important stop in Europe for the art scene. I mean, there are 500 galleries and the gallery scene is extremely strong. Artists flood there from all over Europe to work, but there's no real local market. So Stockholm has a different kind of history. There's a kind of bourgeois history of collecting art and living with art. And so for the size of the city, Stockholm has a lot of high-level galleries. It has, I think, more Konsthals than probably any other city in Europe for the population per capita, and fantastic institutions like Moderna Museet. So on that level, it's still a really strong art city.
Let's walk through and some of the artifacts that are listed. It feels like a writer's set up residency in a gallery. Possibly. It's a very much a gallery feel to it and a writer's room.
And I mean, it's not supposed to be scenography, it's not theatre, it's more like an inventory of objects within the gallery space. But even the gallery lighting is accounted for. On the list, it says fluorescent lights.
And yeah, we're not moodily lit, are we, in here today? We're a little bit supermarket. Yeah.
Well, that's the regular gallery light.
It is bright though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess there's no natural light right back here in the back of the gallery.
Now we're in the second room where these objects are placed out, and here we have the desk and the typewriter, a dictionary. We even have a bookshelf with 47 dictionaries. So as I say, each of the lines, every action and every object is defined by one of these example sentences in the dictionary. So if one looks up the word listen, then the example sentence might be, you must listen to me. But in this case, she's found sentences which define Turkish carpet, a small postcard, a glass with a hairline crack in it. Apart from that, the show is also made up of an audio piece, which, as she was collecting these example sentences, she separated any sentences that dealt with artistry or the act of writing, authorship. And so the sound piece becomes a existential musing over the position of the artist or the author. It's kind of interchangeable in the show.
To be honest, there is a practical difficulty. I am strange to the work. Books aren't really my thing. Reading isn't my thing. It's a matter of working out how to get something done. The dictionary defines it succinctly, the act of writing down one's thoughts. The book that I've just written, considering the conditions, it's very good.
And then the last aspect of the show is maybe the most important and took Meriç nearly a year and a half to produce, and that is an actual novel, which is presented here in the form of a manuscript. And it's the whole narrative. She hasn't written a word herself. It's a collection of these example sentences that she's organized so that they make a running narrative and reads like a slightly clumsy, real novel. I mean, it's an extraordinary feat.
When did you know that you were going to put this show on and the details of the show?
She started telling me about her plans for the show before the summer. We're closed for nearly 2 months during the summer, and she moved into the gallery, used the gallery as her studio, and slowly started to try and find all these objects that were defined by her list, which is no mean feat. I mean,
the list was unchangeable to begin with, and then she had to find the stuff.
She could edit it. Of course, if she couldn't find a certain item, then it couldn't be on the list either. But the list is very expansive, and it's extremely specific sometimes. So there's a stuffed parrot. A stuffed parrot isn't necessarily impossible to find, but then it had to have grey plumage. It gets complicated to try and find a stuffed grey parrot during the month of July in Stockholm So you're looking on eBay, you're looking on all these kind of local auction sites, you're going to secondhand shops. It's really kind of trudging through.
It's almost easy to go and catch one and stuff it yourself.
Yes, exactly.
That was Ben Lovelace from the Nordenhecker Gallery in Stockholm, talking us through Merritt Algen Ringborg's A Work of Fiction. A lot of art there, so we're going to be swapping steeds next. We'll be meeting Qatar's first rock star.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounder. It's time to get a bit rock and roll. Rock music is rarely performed in Qatar. So Jordanian-Pakistani Nasser Mastarihi, who was born and brought up in the country's capital, Doha, is pretty unique. Addicted to electric guitars and rock bands like Metallica and Guns N' Roses since childhood, he recently became the first ever musician to release a rock album from the country. Reporter Victoria Scott went to meet him.
I've always aspired to become a musician since I was a little kid, since I was like 7, 8 years old. My parents used to hear me sing in the shower, and that's actually how I learned how to sing. I never thought it would actually happen. In my teens, I picked up the guitar. I was determined to teach myself how to play, and I just kept pushing the music thing because at first my father was resistant to it. He couldn't stand or tolerate the long hair and the leather jackets and my friends who had like nose piercings and all that, because my dad is in the military. You know, it was a new thing for him, despite the fact that my parents are both extremely liberal. It was, I think, last year that I really sat and thought about it. There was, you know, two routes that I could have taken. Either get a 9-to-5, and the other route was, can I take a year off and just do the music thing and travel and play and record, finish my record and do all of that stuff. This is what I'm best at, right? And this is where I perform my optimum ability.
Rock music is an unusual choice, so not one that really fits with Qatari culture, which is where you were born, where you grew up. So what made you decide to become a rock musician, and how has that been for people around you?
I love all kinds of music. You could say like my music collection is like pretty diverse, you know, but with rock music there was something about it, the sound of the guitar, the strings crashing coming through an amp. Like, I've always had a deep affinity to British rock. Everything from, you know, the Holy Trinity, from Zeppelin, Deep Purple and Black Sabbath, to the 70s scene bands like UFO. You know, like that famous quote that the Beatles were everyone's nursery rhymes. The Beatles were my nursery rhyme. The first record I ever got was a Beatles record. And then it was followed by Guns N' Roses and then Maiden and bands like that. When you ask me, like, why was it rock music that I fell in love with, I guess it was just coincidence, you know. I got a rock record, and for the rest of my life, that was just pretty much the music that I grew up around. They were so raw and they were on an edge. And I was a kid growing up in Doha. Up till my early teens, I was pretty quiet. And so that was my outlet right there.
You grew up here. You are the first Qatari musician to release a rock album from Qatar. Does that give you a sense of pride? Have you had lots of attention about that? Have people been talking to you about that?
In terms of whether I feel pride, I mean, hell yeah, I feel pride. And I even used to joke with my mom, I'm like, oh, I hope one day they erect a monument for me somewhere out there, like Phil Lynott in Dublin. But yeah, some people talk about it. Like, I get some praise. I won't lie. I mean, like, it's kind of weird because I haven't ever gotten the support I feel that I deserve in Doha. Which is bizarre because I've gotten more support in Dubai. And I never understood why. In Dubai, it was much more of a hype thing. The first rock musician out of Qatar. In fact, I landed a TV interview because of it. But here, I mean, it's not till this year that I was ever featured in any publications in Doha. No one was really interested. There was a point where I didn't want to come back because I felt unwelcome in my own home. You know what I mean? But I do love this place and I represent it. So I was like, you know, I'm here now. And if they don't want to print about me or write about me, I'll make them write about me.
And so you've released the album. What next for you? You said you might have to get a job. What is your sort of plan for the next few years?
But yeah, I don't want to quit and I'm not going to stop. And the goal that I have is to reinvigorate the scene here, man. I mean, I think it's pretty dead, you know, and I think the rock community in Doha need to wake up and like need to demand that there's more live venues and shows and events going on. In fact, I heard Metallica announced that they were considering playing here, you know, in an interview recently. And it would be really nice to see that, to see major live acts, you know, from England or America come down and headline stadiums here, because they have the facilities, they have the venues. It's just the only unfortunate thing is the promoters, that someone needs to change their mindset and show them that it's worked in Dubai. So that's pretty much the plan. Get this rock scene, bring it to life and put out my next record. And hopefully, if things work out with that record, probably go on tour next year.
That was Nasser Masterihi, Qatar's first rock star, talking to Victoria Scott. Nasser's album, 1987, which you heard the title track from, is out now on iTunes and can be found in Virgin Megastores in Qatar itself. Still to come in part two, more live tracks from the super talented Julia Holter. We take a look at one of the cultural events from this year's London Design Week and launch a new book about the ukulele in the best possible way, with a ukulele playing competition, no less. If you want to hear a 73-year-old man doing a Lady Gaga cover on a uke, you'd better stay tuned in. So back to our Midori House session, Julia Holter, who had a lot to say to Monocle's Paul Noble about her home city of LA when she stopped by at Midori House. But before we hear that chat, first here's Julia with another track from her new album, Loud City Song. This is In the Green Wild.
City shoes, fun ways, dumb green, fertile valleys. I never could fall straight and let's it shoot. Someone with the thing you say, straight on a leaf and lets it fall into my feet. Da, 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 da. I received the news, so small a child who cannot understand. I can't hear and I don't know, and the wind slows down and still the trees are trees. So calm and for a moment to make sense, but the tree says wow wow, and the language is strange, the woman's wow wow. Wow, wow, and the language is strange, the woman's wow, wow. Am I too bored to understand? Well, good, I'm done. Off to the wild for me. In the green wild I am gone, my hands to shoulders gone, but the shoes my feet have worn still remain. And they walk toward the sea, there's a flavor to the sound of walking no one ever noticed before. In the green wild I am gone, my hands to shoulders gone, but the shoes my feet have worn still remain. And they walk toward the sea, there's a flavor to the sound of walking no one ever noticed before. In the green wild I am gone, my hands to shoulders gone, but the shoes my feet have worn still remain. And they walk toward the sea, there's a flavor to the sound of walking no one ever noticed before. Ooh.
Julia Holter, welcome to Monocle, and thank you for doing your session today.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit about the album, because this is your third album, but it's your first on Domino Records.
Yes.
And it's a bit of a leap forward from your last two.
I don't know. I think of it as just a different record. It was recorded more professionally in a studio, so I think the main noticeable difference is the richer frequency spectrum, just because I'm dealing with like a more hi-fi situation. So yeah, it was, and then also that I had instruments, like other musicians playing on the record, whereas in the past I had a few guests, but for the most part it was just me, so now we have an ensemble.
It's an LA album. You've grown up in LA, and you've collaborated with a lot of people from the LA scene. It seems like LA is this, you know, it's where all the films and loads of music is made, but it's not a very introspective place thematically. People don't really look into LA culture for music. They see it as like, well, this is just a day-to-day thing. Whereas on this album, you've, a lot of the themes of your songs are about LA and the culture of the city.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think LA is the thing about it. It's written about all the time. It's sung about. It's in movies, but it's really hard to define it.
Hmm.
It's just very spread out, and there's millions of different kinds of people, and it's very, you can't put it in a nutshell. It's just really all over the place. There's not one way to look at it, and it never gets boring, and I love LA so much. And I have so much space there to do my work, and it can be a very quiet place.
And so where are you based? Are you in the city, or are you up in the hills?
I'm in Echo Park.
Right. And so what's the music scene there like?
It's a very concentrated music scene there, but it's very all over the place, and I don't know a lot of people anymore. I feel like I have a kind of small, there's a venue, Echo, everyone plays, and it's, there's all these kind of like young people, artists, places, you know, and it's really just a beautiful location. In fact, Echo Park is historically kind of an artist's place. It started as the, before Hollywood, it was the Hollywood, it was the silent movie center of silent movies, and it was called Edendale. So it has a history of this artistic scene. It's very beautiful.
You've collaborated with and sort of passed through some of the key Californian institutions, CalArts and Dublab. Let's talk about those because they've both played a pretty big part in your music.
Yeah.
Let's explain CalArts, what it is.
Well, CalArts is a school that is unusual because it's sort of basically just a place where people do what they want as opposed to an academic institution. It is. I mean, it's a school and you get a degree, but I think that both the faculty and students that are there are kind of just do what they want. When I was there, I didn't really like have a lot in common with the other composers because everyone just did such different things. But that's good because they all do what they want as opposed to like more conservative conservatory vibe where people are kind of like encouraged of a certain aesthetic or something.
And Dublab, for those that don't know, is an LA-based sort of music collective, started life as an internet radio station and has now branched out into events. How did you get involved with them?
I think through Jason. When I first came to LA, I got involved with Human Ear Music, which was a label that my friend Jason ran that included like Ariel Pink and Geneva Jacuzzi, which was then Bubonic Plague, and like all these cool musicians that make their own music, really, or self-recorded.
And they've always got behind, you know, deeply experimental electronic stuff. They're an outlet for music which a lot of other people...
Dublab.
Yeah, Dublab. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't always fit into a conventional radio station playlist. How did they start with you?
So Jason knew them somehow, was in touch with them, and he had me go in for a live show that they recorded when I was like just starting to do live shows. And they were so into it and like were really supportive of me and like put it online so people around the world could hear it. And of course, not a million people listened, but some people did. And that was really cool for me to like, it was like some people heard my music, just like no one knew who I was. So it was exciting. So I just have done a lot of shows with them in the past.
That was Julia Holter talking to Paul Noble there. Julia's new album, Loud City Song, is out now on Domino. She's also on tour in the US and will be back in Europe later this year. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. There's one more track from Julia still to come, plus why Allen Ginsberg loved a kitchen sink, and a eulogy to the oft misunderstood ukulele. Don't you dare go anywhere.
the ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn, and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. Yes, it's still me, Robert Bounds, so you must be tuned into Culture on Monocle 24. Where else would you see a 73-year-old man doing a cover of Lady Gaga's Bad Romance, or a 13-year-old boy finger-picking Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine to a silent room of onlookers? Well, at the Ukulele Player of the Year competition, of course. It's a new annual event set up by Tom Hodgkinson and Gavin Preter-Penny, founders of the fantastic mag The Idler, to celebrate the launch of a new book they've just co-written, The Ukulele Handbook. The competition took place on Friday night down at the Idler Academy in West London, and producer Katie, ever the keen uke player, went along to meet Tom and Gavin, find out more about the book and how the pros do it.
This was Ukulele Player of the Year, so we had to sort of distance ourselves from the songwriting side to it. Two of the performers played their own compositions, and they were impressive songs, actually, so it was quite hard in a way to not allow that to colour our judgment. So it was the overall performance that we were going for, and that was also tricky because, you know, we had some who were going for the kind of humorous performance, and a ukulele is an instrument that's perfectly kind of pitched to be a kind of comic prop because it's so small. The sound is this kind of high plinkety sound, this rhythmic high sound. It is kind of amusing.
His name is Gordon. He is the traffic warden. He gave me a ticket and I told him where to stick it. Said I had to pay a fine for a double yellow line. But that was just the start, because I paid him with my heart.
So, you know, some people were playing on that and then some were doing more serious things. So it was really hard to make a distinction. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think it was just simply, it's a feeling, you know, who presents themselves best, who does the best performance, who technically seemed most accomplished. And you know, I think the best player won, clearly.
My bed is cold and though it's small, all extra space is wasted. Without you here to hold me near and stay my brain from racing.
Skunk Boy, just crowned Ukulele Player of the Year. What does that title mean to you?
Oh, it means a great deal to me, being as the ukulele is one of the main kind of facets of my music. I'm very proud.
And what did you think about the standard of the competition tonight?
It was amazing, and everybody really did bring something different to the table. Like, there was nobody who had a kind of samey act as someone else. It didn't get boring, you know. Everyone had their own flavour and their own style of playing the ukulele. I really enjoyed it.
And did you have any personal favourite acts out of the competition, apart from yourself, of course?
Well, I loved Ukulele Eric, of course, and his Bad Romance cover, which was astounding. I was not expecting that.
I'm now 73 and I started playing when I was 65. My advice is very, very simple. There's no magic trick or anything. It's get it out of the box or the case or whatever it's in and practice, practice, practice.
And what is it that you like about the ukulele? Why do you play it rather than any other instrument?
You can practice in bed.
I often think of it as an instrument that perhaps misunderstood sometimes.
Well, it's an interesting sort of point, and it's something that has been present throughout the history of this instrument since it, you know, people talk about the instrument being really invented, as it were, in Hawaii in 1879, isn't it, Tom? And, you know, since that time, what we've said in the book is that its popularity has gone in waves, and we really saw there being three waves of popularity for the ukulele. And in between them, it's kind of ended up being an instrument of ridicule. And what's interesting about it is that it's always on that brink between being a serious instrument in its own right, and being a kind of comedy prop, you know. There aren't so many instruments that have that, really, you know. They tend to be one or the other.
On Hawaii, there are lots of really serious ukulele players, and there always have been, but at the same time, it's mocked. And even from the beginning, in the 1880s, I think, you know, some local wags in Honolulu called it a hideous little instrument. Bertie Wooster plays it, horrifies his neighbours. In fact, Jeeves leaves his employment because of his ukulele playing, because he plays this song called I Want an Automobile with a horn that goes toot, toot, toot. So I suppose that would have been in the 1930s. Is it a serious instrument? Is it an object of mockery? It's both.
Now it's a job that just suits me.
About how you came to the decision to make the book and what's in it.
We have lots of feelings about the instrument as to why it's an interesting instrument. The democratic nature of the ukulele, the fact that it's easy to start to learn, you only need one finger to play the chord of C, the fact that it's an unpretentious instrument, the fact that it's an instrument that brings people together, because the more people who are playing, the better it sounds generally. So there are all those reasons, but there's also, we felt there was a demand, there was a need for one book that really had the three elements, I think, that you want when you start playing the ukulele. You want to know about this rich and interesting history of the instrument. You want to kind of have lessons so you can learn. So we've got a 6-week course in it, as well as a kind of this history with lots of visual stuff. It's very visually rich, the history of the instrument. Beautiful early examples from Hawaii, the beautiful iconography in the 50s, all the plastic ukuleles that were around then. And then also song sheets at the back for popular songs. So we felt there wasn't a book that did all those three things.
It's called The Ukulele Handbook. It's published by Bloomsbury. It's widely available. It's been published in America in November. It's already, I think, available in Australia. And you can also buy it mail order from the Idler shop. You pay the full price, but it's a signed copy.
That's two signatures you get as well, isn't it?
Yeah, you get two signatures, you know. And it's quite a lot of work for us to sit down and sign the books, get it together to do all that. So, I mean, obviously that's going to be worth a lot more money than the Amazon version. So we do recommend people buy it direct from the Idler. Idler.co.uk. Stroke shop.
You're fourth on my list of lovable evil dictators. After Stalin, Mussolini and Hitler, you're the greatest. And if you yearn to learn what undo that status, you're a cynical...
The sound of the Skunk Boy Project crowns the Idler's Ukulele Player of the Year, and you heard Tom Hodgkinson and Gavin Pretter-Penny talking to culture producer Katie there. The Ukulele Handbook, as you heard, is published by Bloomsbury and can be bought anywhere around the world on the Idler website. Last week, the London Design Festival rolled into town, bringing with it an eclectic mix of all things creative. One event which caught our eye here on Culture is a small exhibition space in Hoxton, East London, which runs all month. The food and cultural journal The Gourmand and artisan baker's Black Isle Bakery have joined forces with gallery and bookshop KK Outlet to create a multifaceted exhibition with a relaxed vibe and a kick-your-shoes-off kind of atmosphere. The centrepiece is a collection of photographs inspired by the American poet Allen Ginsberg, who supposedly wrote his finest work whilst gazing out at the same kitchen window for 30 years. We sent Monocle's Chris Fitch down to the space to find out more.
My name's Danielle Pendon. We're at KK Outlet on Hoxton Square. We are a ground floor gallery. In the front section, we have a shop, which at the minute is stocked with food and design-related products and publications. We have hand-painted plates from Darkroom. We have jams and chutneys from the London Borough of Jam. We have a series of illustrative prints, which are from the Gourmand. So we've got a print by Jean Julien, Nouveau, Jan Lebec, and Paul Davis.
My name's Marina Tweed and I am the co-founder and co-editor-in-chief of The Gourmand. So here we are 1 year in and three issues in, about to go to print with our fourth issue. We noticed a little gap in the market that there were lots of food magazines, lots of recipe magazines, chef magazines, and we just really wanted to combine the food, art and culture world and talk about food in a more abstract way, so we would never write directly about food. There's lots of lovely magazines that do that very well, and we didn't want to create another one. You know, we saw the niche, and so we would rather talk to artists about their interest in food, or to people who work in food, such as chefs, about their interest in art. So we'd probably sort of hardly even feature a plate of food in the magazine. That doesn't happen as such. It's more an abstract way.
Design's definitely
the other co-founder of The Gourmand, David Lane, gives me a run through exactly how this abstract approach to food and culture is manifested as an exhibition, starting with the illustrated artwork hung on the wall as you enter the gallery.
So this half of the gallery is really just content from the journal brought to life on the wall as an addition. I really like Jan's drawing, him and his brother, the French illustrators, and they really love documenting kind of working markets and shops of cities. And he, in the last issue, we did a piece where he drew all of the, he spent a week sketching at Smithfield's meat market. His brother went to Billingsgate, and they're printed in blue and red, the same colours that the meat and fish chopping boards are of the two different markets. Because they're brothers and they've grown up together, their styles kind of overlap, but they're also really recognisably different. So it's very nice. And they're kind of very timeless and humorous, and they're very good.
David then leads me through to the second half of the gallery, where, as well as several people sat around enjoying tea and cake, we find the central focus of the exhibition.
This second space, the gallery space, is just a photography exhibition that we curated, again using lots of photographers that we work with through the magazine and also people we'd like to work with. But rather than just using existing content, it's all work that was commissioned specifically for the show. And we were in San Francisco at the Jewish Museum. There was a Allen Ginsberg exhibition of his photography. And there's a reoccurring image of him looking out of his window in his apartment in Manhattan every morning. And it was obviously where he sat to think and write. And we thought, because we were going to be having the Black Art Bakery serving tea, it'd be really lovely if in the morning you could come in and have your coffee and look out at the views from around the world of where other people sit in the morning and look out of their windows. So these, it's an exhibition of kind of early morning views, really. There's Tokyo and Manhattan and Hackney and Stockholm and all sorts of different places. Some are like more as you'd expect. I mean, this one's great. It's a Dutch photography duo, amazing still life duo. And it's a drawing by Lisbeth's mother of their kitchen, but the photograph's taken in the glass of the drawing reflecting their actual kitchen. And then you see the reflection of the rest of the space in the glass, so it's quite...
It takes a few moments to actually kind of get your head around that one.
Yeah, exactly. There's quite a lot going on. And then this one, for example, Ben McMahon, is just a really beautiful view from his window in Hackney, but it really could be anywhere. There's a kind of classic, like, Williamsburg wooden shuttered house with an amazing morning shadow on it. And then Gustav Almestel in Stockholm, who had some interesting objects sitting around in his kitchen tables, created a still life. So there's lots of variety.
Is there any particular message that you think you've taken from seeing the different images that are covering the one kind of theme?
I think it's just really interesting to get a personal insight from each person. I don't know, it's not a time you often spend with people first thing in the morning. You know, the people you spend that time with are often quite close to you, so it's, I think you get a sense of that, hopefully, and it's kind of an interesting personal insight into each person.
I am Ruth Barry, and I am the founder and head baker of Black Owl Bakery. We are doing a very lovely little tea room cake shop.
What for you is the connection between what you do in the bakery and the exhibition we've got here at KK Outlet?
I think the London Design Festival is obviously about innovation and experimentation. a high quality product, something exciting. And I think that's been really great to be part of that. The Gourmand magazine is just, it's one of my favourite magazines. From the first issue that came out, I knew that it was just going to be something really special and different. And I think we share the same sensibilities and the same kind of approach to art, food and culture. And KK is just a really fun place to be, I think. It's been a really exciting collaboration for us all to come together and just see how three very different companies can come together to create one kind of quite cohesive experience for the visitors.
For Monocle, I'm Chris Fitch.
And if you're in London and interested in checking out that show, it's on at the KK Outlet in the city's east and until the end of the month. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be investigating the Istanbul Biennale and getting the lowdown on this year's Pop Montreal. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bulbauer, and Holly Fisher worked her magic again with an audio wand. Time for one final song this week from her Midori House session and her new album, Loud City Song. This is Julia Holter with World. Thank you, as ever, for tuning in.
Mr.